This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Eatonville is one of the oldest black towns in the United States. So why did Eatonville survive when other black towns have not? Joining us for more is NY Netheri with the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community. Thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure to be on your air.
We're also joined by Everett Fly. He's a landscape architect, recipient of the National Endowment for the Humanities Medal for his work to preserve the integrity of African-American places and landmarks. Everett, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Everett, I want to start with you. How unique is Eatonville, and how many places like it were there once?
Well, Eatonville is absolutely unique. There were never an enormous number of black towns. Most of them were settlements. They were never incorporated as a municipal body. So there were probably more than 2,000 settlements across the United States from the time of the establishment of the colonies to today. And so the communities that were actually incorporated as governmental bodies, there were probably more than a couple of hundred. And so to have Eatonville still alive and functioning is extremely unique.
How did Eatonville first come across your radar? Because you were instrumental in making sure that a road was not built through this town. So how did that happen?
Well, I had actually researched through archives and newspaper accounts the existence and the evolution of Eatonville. And I had a classmate when I was in the Graduate School of Design at Harvard who happened to be from Orlando. And he became aware of the challenge or the threat of the road to Eatonville. And if I remember correctly, he suggested that Mrs. Netheri contact me and see if I could be of some help.
Had you sort of helped out other towns or other municipalities or other places that were facing destruction, kind of make sure they got that historic status and survived before Eatonville? Was this the first one?
No. By the time that I got to work in Eatonville, I had done similar work for the National Park Service and the National Trust for Historic Preservation in communities like or states like Kansas, California, Maryland, and Michigan.
Why is it important to preserve places like Eatonville? Why do you think it's important to make sure that they don't just vanish or get swallowed up by other municipalities?
Well, places like Eatonville are actually contributors to the overall civic and educational and cultural life of America. In other words, they don't only help black people. They help white people. They help Native American and indigenous people. They help people of all persuasions, demographic, economic sectors. So we have a bad habit in America of just saying, well, the black towns helped themselves and no one else. But they were actually parts of networks, economic networks, educational networks, even environmental networks that helped and benefited us all. So every time we lose one, we lose a part of the overall legacy and content of America, civic life, cultural life, and heritage.
NY Netheri, let me bring you in on the conversation. Aside from the work of Mr. Fly and making sure that road didn't get built through Eatonville, that the town survived, what else would you put it down to, the fact that Eatonville has persisted and it now has this identity as the place of Zora Neale Hurston? You have the festival every year. What is it that keeps the town going?
I would say that there are four foundational pieces or aspects of Eatonville life that account for its ability, at least internally, to persist. And those pieces are faith in God, a family, education, the commitment to doing the best you could educationally, and civic pride. From an internal perspective, I think that those really are the blocks upon which the town stands. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to hear the question that you ask about how is it that actually Eatonville has survived from an external perspective, because, of course, we know what happened historically in Rosewood. Mm-hmm. We know what has happened in the what was called the Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We may not have time on this air, but it would be very interesting to hear Everett Fly weigh in on the external threat. And, of course, we know what happened in Ocoee.
Right.
Literally today, maybe half an hour's drive west of Eatonville. So Eatonville has been able to survive because of its internal strengths, but it's also not been challenged by the overt racial antagonism that has been perpetrated in other places in this country historically.
And when you talk about Ocoee and Rosewood, I mean, the destruction of those places, those were external issues, right?
Exactly.
That wasn't just sort of economic decline.
No, the whites came and killed and pushed out the people who were there. So there's not any finesse to this. They were actually obliterated because of physical force.
What about the sense of what keeps Eatonville going now, though? I mean, there must be some challenges economically. You mentioned education as one of the bedrocks of what keeps Eatonville going, but are there some challenges there, access to education?
Oh, absolutely. I think that if you look at the two initiatives that our organization has made a generational commitment to internally, it is about education. We talk about the 21st century workforce and the good-paying jobs. Those are all connected basically to science, technology, engineering, and math. Well, happily, Eatonville has a legacy of that kind of educational structure with the historic Robert Hungerford Industrial and Normal School. So for us as a preservation organization, we're looking to build upon that mm-hmm. as a basis for seeing the community galvanize around that educational excellence, which is so much a part of the history. So without a doubt, the focus on educational excellence, and not just in first grade or the elementary schools, we're looking at what we call very early childhood intervention mm-hmm. and having families appreciate the importance of toddlers, 2 and 3 years old, really being exposed to the kinds of inputs that will allow them to succeed.
Education is one thing. What about the kinds of things that are going to keep folks in Eatonville? Are there opportunities for people in Eatonville, or do they have to look outside the boundaries of the town?
But historically, and this is a nice point, Eatonville historically has always been known as a bedroom community.
Mm-hmm.
We are not the kind of historic black town that Boley, Oklahoma was, for example, or even Mound Bayou, Mississippi, where there were banking institutions and certain institutional infrastructure that allowed people to work in Eatonville. We have always, as a community, worked outside and slept, recreated, governed within the context of the community. So the fact that our challenge is just to make certain that the young people coming up have the ability to work around the Central Florida area and the good-paying jobs, and then they can come back to Eatonville as a bedroom community, because historically that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. Everett Fly, back to the question about kind of external forces or what it looks like from somebody outside of Eatonville looking in, aside from jumping in and just sort of telling the county, look, there's a historic reason why you shouldn't build a road through this town, what else, from your point of view, keeps a place like Eatonville going?
Well, obviously the fact that the town governs itself. In other words, the civil right to be able to govern yourself allows the town to be able to stand up, say, we don't want the road, and have a legal voice, have precedence to do that, and make its own decision. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, in all these towns that have the category of municipal incorporated communities, they all have that ability. The places that were just settlements, many of them have been, as NY pointed out, have been wiped out because they didn't have that tool, governance tool, to be able to stand up and make a case in either direction. And then by the same point, if Eatonville wanted to, on its own, develop some strategies or develop some or some initiatives to do things internally, they, as a government, they have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. What about places like Goldsboro, which was annexed by Sanford many, many years ago, but they still have a sense of identity? They have some economic challenges, perhaps, but how does a place like Goldsboro kind of preserve what they have still?
Well, again, they're citizens of that community and citizens of the United States. So they have the right and the opportunity to stand up and take what they would like to have or not. But in any case, they still contribute, just like I said at the beginning, they still contribute to the overall network of neighborhoods, as NY just pointed out, civic activities and civic role in a community.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, you know, any community like Goldsboro should protect its heritage. They should do as much research and documentation as they can, and do as much as they can in terms of education, educating the residents of the neighborhood about the importance of their history, as well as the larger community that might control them. It's so important for these communities to stand up and expose their own history and protect it.
I'm wondering, too, after your work with Eatonville, did you get a flood of inquiries from other towns, other places, wanting to see what they could do to preserve what they had? And I'm wondering if things have changed in the last two decades as to the approach to or the attitude towards preserving places of significance to African-American communities or Latino communities or other communities in the United States.
Well, no, I did not get a flood of inquiries after Eatonville. It's been more like a steady growth of inquiries. One of the reasons is I think there's a growing awareness of the significance of cultural history and cultural resources in community planning, city planning, and that kind of thing. But then, on the other hand, there are programs such as within the National Park Service. Since the time I started working with Eatonville, there are initiatives like the Historic Cultural Settlements and Historic Cultural Landscape Initiative. And those particularly allow protection of communities, well, like Goldsboro or Eatonville. And when I started out with the work, those programs were not in place. So it's very difficult to make the case and put a place like Goldsboro on the National Register, for example, which would lend it some protection. But now we have National Park Service has those kinds of initiatives, and then they pass those down to the various states to implement them as well. So that's made it easier. But it's been more kind of a steady growth.
If I could, I'd like to add that over the, I would say, last decade, we are seeing within these communities, neighborhoods, and settlements, we see ourselves as a colleague, a lot of interest. For example, in 2014, the formation of the Historic Black Towns and Settlements Alliance really reflects a bit of what your question asks.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a four-state collaborative of towns, Tuskegee, Alabama, Hobson City, Alabama, Mound Bayou, Mississippi, and Grambling, Louisiana, in addition to Eatonville. Now, there's an in-common connection with Booker T. Washington, the founder of Tuskegee Institute, but I would say to you that we have seen, for example, a year-round inquiry on a regular basis to us as a historic preservation organization. And in that instance, I would echo what Everett Fly has said about a kind of interest within these communities and neighborhoods to try to stand up and make certain that the history and culture that they represent is captured and appreciated both by their children, but also from the larger external community as well.
NYU Theory is with the Association to Preserve Eatonville Community. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
We're also joined by Everett Fly. He's a landscape architect, recipient of the National Endowment for Humanities Medal for his work to preserve the integrity of African-American places and landmarks. Everett, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come.
We have a member in our organization. He's a Vietnam veteran. He's 72 years old, and he can powerlift 235 pounds. And he's a double amputee and paralyzed.
Central Florida athletes at the National Veterans Wheelchair Games when Intersection returns. If you missed an episode, you can download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Hundreds of athletes compete in Cincinnati this week at the National Veterans Wheelchair Games. 90.7's Catherine Welch spoke to Steve Kirk, president of the Central Florida chapter of the Paralyzed Veterans of America, and John DeMauro, the group's executive director, about the role of sports in improving the lives of the organization's members. Kirk began the conversation.
I was injured snow skiing in Colorado in 1980, and then for a while I was just hanging around at home. One day some guy stopped and says, "Have you ever thought about joining the Paralyzed Veterans?" I said, "I didn't even know it existed." So I come down, was here a few times, and got somewhat involved. And then later on, I come back and got a little more serious about it and got on the board. And then after that, I thought I could take over the vice president's job and learn what was going on. And I ended up being president for the first one. About the last 9 years, I've been president down here.
And you're a veteran of what branch?
I'm in the Army. That's part of the Signal Corps. And went to Fort Monmouth for training, did well there. They put me in a satellite class, and I ended up in Asmara, Ethiopia.
John, what's your story?
I am not a veteran. I had polio when I was an infant, when it was time for being drafted into during the Vietnam era. I wasn't eligible medically. I joined this organization 3 years ago. So when I came to this organization 3 years ago, I came with the intent and hope to help the program improve.
And Steve, what is it like to be a member of this group?
Since we've got the sports program going, we meet bowling, we've done air rifles. The other day we went to see about doing archery, so it's growing quite a bit, and that's where the camaraderie starts to occur, is when you're doing sports and everybody's getting tips on how to do something, because we do it, but we do it quite a bit differently than the able-bodied community does.
And what challenges do your members face?
Like if I want to get a new chair, they have a $3,000 limit on it, and then they have to go through a number of different committees to get approved with. And most chairs start about $3,000 and go up, so that can be a roadblock to us.
And is that something the Paralyzed Veterans of America Central Florida chapter helps its members with?
We do. We also have a national organization, and they work for it too. But we send people up once a year to meet all our congressmen and try to promote what we need to have done to help our members.
Accessibility to affordable wheelchairs and other equipment, does that seem to be the biggest challenge? Or
There's a number of them. The other one is be flying on an airplane. That can be really tough for somebody. So you get there, and they don't take good care of your equipment. So if you get there and your chair has been broken by the airlines, it's, you know, you can't just go down the street and get another one, because they're all very built, you know, to meet the person's needs, and everybody's different.
John DeMauro, what are other services your organization provides that folks who are neither veterans nor paralyzed would even realize need to be provided?
For our paralyzed veterans, probably the most important thing is the sports and recreation, because it does a couple things. First of all, it helps them therapeutically. Obviously, when someone is confined to a wheelchair, there's limited movement. The fact that they're sitting in a chair, not upright, and so many other issues that they have, it leads to other physical problems that people don't even think about. Often when they see someone in a wheelchair and realize they're paralyzed, they think, oh, how sad that is that they can't walk. And even though that is an issue, the greater issues are beyond that. There are physical issues both with internal organs that aren't functioning the way they should function, normally function, or they're not placed the way they should be. When you're upright, your body organs internally sit differently than when you're sitting down. And if you're sitting down all the time, that can create problems. Some of the challenges that we try to help our members with are prosthetically the equipment that they might need and helping to make sure that they get what they need when they need it. And that's sometimes an issue, as he shared. Also, when people find themselves paralyzed, they isolate themselves. They don't feel like they're a part of the society any longer. So our intent is to try to get them out of the house, get them into the community for two reasons. Number one, it's good for them. And number two, it's good for the community. The more that the community sees people in power wheelchairs and the different types of wheelchairs that that these folks are in, the better they understand the challenges they face. And I can think of a community here in our own area, I won't necessarily mention the city, but where the crosswalks across the street don't go where the cutouts are in the curbs. And so when somebody in a wheelchair, a power wheelchair like Steve is, and he's trying to cross the street, he goes to the crosswalk, but he can't get to the crosswalk. So he has to go down the block a little further to where the curb cutout is and then come back on the street to get to the crosswalk to get across the street. And so those are some challenges that they face.
I was going to ask, how handicapped accessible is Central Florida?
Orlando is fairly accessible. I think we rarely run into problems in Orlando or in or around the Orlando area. This is a tourist community, and so certainly the parks are very accommodating.
And what's your sense of handicap accessibility along the coast, say Volusia or Brevard County?
Well, obviously, people in these wheelchairs, like the chair that Steve is sitting in right now, weighs probably 200, 250 pounds, the chair itself. With him in it, now all of a sudden you're looking at a 400 to 450 pound object. To try to get on the beach is next to impossible. We've been fortunate in that we had a donor come to us and see that we live in a beach community, and it'd be nice if they can get out on the beach. He actually bought two special made power beach chairs that we have in the other room to where our members, if they ever want to go on the beach, they can come and get one of these chairs, and it will take them anywhere any able-bodied person can go outside of into the water because they're electronic.
Steve, sports plays a big role in the Paralyzed Veterans of America of Central Florida chapter. You have lots of sports offerings. What have you seen sports do to improve the lives of your organization's members?
Just getting people out, getting them busy. Like they do cocoon. If you get them out just one or two times, then they start to feel more comfortable. They're willing to go other places. So, and then it builds up camaraderie between people. Because when I first got injured, I'd go and see other quads or quadriplegics and see how they did things so I could learn how to do things for myself and try to be a little more independent. This way they get out and they can see more people and get a better idea how to get through life and handle the challenges that comes their way.
Is there someone who is currently a member or was a member in the past that you actually watched them come out of that cocoon through sports? And what was their story?
Because Danny Guppenberger just recently injured about a year or so ago. And before he was just at his house, and that was it. Now he's going bowling regularly. He's been in here for air rifle training. And then he's also doing powerlifting. He has a friend come in here and they work together once a week doing bench presses.
So the wheelchair games are coming up. The national ones are coming up in Cincinnati, Ohio. What are these games? How does this work?
The National Veteran Wheelchair Games is the largest wheelchair event in the country. In Cincinnati this year, they're expecting close to 600 veteran wheelchair athletes who will be participating in 19 different events, everything from rugby, basketball, field events, archery, bowling, soccer, bocce ball, the list goes on. There's 19 different events, and it's an Olympic-type atmosphere, and it's for 5 days these events take place. Powerlifting, We have a member in our organization. He's a Vietnam veteran. He's 72 years old, and he can power lift 235 pounds. And he's a double amputee and paralyzed. And so this guy is just an amazing guy, and sports is so important to him in his life. He's involved in track events, javelin throw, shot put throw. So all of these are Olympic events.
And Orlando will be hosting next year's wheelchair games. How did that come to happen? Was that part of this chapter bringing it here? Or?
Yes, we were very much involved, and the city of Orlando has been very responsive.
And with the National Wheelchair Games coming to Orlando in 2018, how handicap accessible is it? Is it ready for these 600 competitors to arrive in a year?
Well, that's a great question. And we already have been, we've had meetings at the airport with the airlines about receiving 600 athletes in wheelchairs in one weekend, because the travel days are Saturday and Sunday. So 600 to 700 wheelchairs are coming in that two-day period. Also, the convention center is very accessible. We're very fortunate in that. Our athletes will be staying in the Rosen Hotels, which are both attached to that side of the convention center. And Mr. Rosen has been very accommodating to us as well. Not all hotels have a lot of accessible rooms. However, one of those Rosen Hotels has almost 100 accessible rooms, which is nice for our athletes. Most cities anymore, because of the American Disabilities Act, are accessible.
Steve Kirk, Chapter President, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very well.
John DeMauro, Executive Director of the Paralyzed Veterans of America Central Florida Chapter, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having us.
Still to come.
April 29th, there was a double homicide before, and it was a homicide while we was actually walking. So literally some of our people saw this, the actual situation happen. And a lot of times people are like, well, you know, should you get out of there? I'm like, no, we need to be here more.
Walking for Peace in Pine Hills. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Miles Mulrain formed the nonprofit Let Your Voice Be Heard to try and help the Pine Hills community escape the cycle of violent crime. We'll hear from Mulrain about the work he's doing, from monthly meetings to peace walks and community fairs. First, though, Captain Carlos Torres of the Orange County Sheriff's Office explains how a spate of violent crime in Pine Hills last year prompted an initiative called Operation Rise.
If we go back to December 2016, we saw a slight increase in some of the violent crime around the Pine Hills neighborhoods. In particular, the areas of Silver Star and Pine Hills Road, in which, unfortunately, we had the loss of a life of a mother, and in addition to other incidents that we had in that area.
And just for our listeners, that was a young woman who was shot at a gas station, right?
That's correct. In addition to that, you know, we have an interesting area within Pine Hills, because we share Pine Hills with the city of Orlando as well. And they had also seen a spike of violent crime along the North Lane and Pine Hills area. So together, Sheriff Jerry Demings, along with Chief Mina, decided to do something proactive in the area. And once again, show and demonstrate to the wonderful people of the Pine Hills community that we're here to stand by them, that we're here to protect them, and that we're here to let those criminals know that they're not going to come into the Pine Hills community and commit crimes, because we're not going to tolerate it, we're not going to stand for it, and we're going to bring them to justice if they do commit crimes. So in conjunction with the city of Orlando, we developed an operation titled RISE. The acronym stands for Restoring Inclusiveness, Safety, and Empowerment. And together we, in conjunction with both the City of Orlando and the Orange County Sheriff's Office, embarked in a six-week operation in which we targeted those individuals that were committing violent crimes in the Pine Hills area. And we made numerous arrests. We recovered numerous amounts of firearms and narcotics were seized as a result of that operation. And what we were able to do is we were able to reduce violent crime by 33%. So when looking at the operation, do we say that that's a success? Absolutely, because every time we stop a violent crime or we prevented a violent crime, that's a success in our eyes.
But it's only 6 weeks. Is that long enough, or do you think it could have kept going longer?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, so what we do is that was the initial part of Operations Rise, which was also, it was a multi-facet approach. So not only did we have the enforcement side, but we also had the community outreach side. We had assistance from the state attorney's office. We had assistance from other law enforcement agencies. We had assistance from social service agencies. So it was a multi-pronged approach in which we targeted the area for the benefit of everybody who lives, you know, works, resides there, does business there. So when you're looking at the timeline, that was just the enforcement side of the operation. So that was the law enforcement part. But we never left Pine Hills. We've always been in Pine Hills. We continue to be in Pine Hills. And we have a pretty good footprint in the Pine Hills community, where we constantly are working with members of the community to ensure that everyone feels safe in the community, that they know that we support the community, and that they know that at any given point we are going to be standing with them side by side, combating the evil that sometimes, unfortunately, is brought on by a selected few in the community. Because if you look at Pine Hills as a whole, Pine Hills is a great community. It has it's rich in traditions, it's rich in culture. The residents of Pine Hills have true pride in their Pine Hills community. Unfortunately, there's a couple of individuals out there who prey on victims that live within the community, and they cause so much havoc at times. And it's just, like I said again, it's not a lot of them. It's just a few that just go out there on a continuous basis and just, you know, commit crimes and, you know, really, truly affect the quality of life of the residents and the business owners in Pine Hills.
Do you get the sense, Captain Torres, that residents in Pine Hills trust law enforcement? Is there a good working relationship between yourselves and the folks who live there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, once again, you know, you have to establish relationships. And when you have relationships, relationships is truly what the foundation of keeping a community safe. So we work on relationships every day. We continuously reach out. We participate in community meetings, community events. We have an open line of communications with our leaders in our communities, our activists in our community, where we're constantly talking. The conversations are always going. We don't wait till something bad occurs for us to then open those lines of communication. And I think that's what makes our approach and the approach that community has with us a very unique one, where we're proactively all the time trying to bridge the gaps, trying to establish and fortify our relationships with the community. Because ultimately we know that we can't do this by ourselves. Law enforcement cannot do this by themselves. We need the power of the community to join our forces, to join our efforts in making sure that they also have an active role in keeping their community safe and assisting us in our efforts. And how do they do that? Well, they do that by reporting crime. They do that by, you know, if they see something, they're going to say something. And that helps us, once again, bring those individuals that are committing the crimes to justice. Because what we don't want is we don't want a community to live in fear. That's what we don't want. And so we work really hard to make sure that our community feels comfortable with us, where they can reach out with us, and that they know that we're there to support them.
Captain Carlos Torres with the Orange County Sheriff's Office, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Well, now law enforcement has launched another initiative to combat violent crime called Operation Ceasefire. Miles Mulrain Jr. is the president of the Pine Hills nonprofit Let Your Voice Be Heard. Miles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, man. I'm glad to be here.
We're also joined by Emery James, who also goes by Zulu Dynasty. Emery, thanks again for coming in.
Yes, sir.
So start us off by talking about Operation Ceasefire. This is an initiative which has been launched with local law enforcement to try and help kind of bring down the crime rate. What's going on there?
Operation Ceasefire is something that it combines the government, law enforcement, and programs on the street level like ours. And, you know, our main emphasis with Operation Ceasefire is to stop the violence and also stop the recidivism rate, bring down the incarceration rate, most importantly. Mm-hmm. And it takes a little bit of a lot of community involvement, because a lot of this is coming out of people on the ground level, reaching out to the youth and reaching out to the people who are at risk of being a victim or a suspect, and literally just giving them resources and programs that will kind of deter them away from it. So it's a way to kind of prevent people going to jail and getting incarcerated. And then with the law enforcement part, they just are understanding what we're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So they're cooperating with groups like ours and groups at the other parts that are basically trying to stop them from getting to the point of going to jail.
How do you identify people who are at risk?
It's a five-factor part that they do. You know, there's a lot of training that goes with it, that there's different circumstances that if a person meets at least four of the five factors, they're going to be the person we address first. That's somebody who's either been involved in a shooting or was shot recently, someone who has a record of getting into something that might be related to violence, and different things along that line. They have a system they use, and we literally just target the people that we know need the help.
Do you think people who have been shot recently or might have been involved in it, are they going to be willing to talk to an organization like yours, or are they going to be a little bit kind of standoffish?
Well, you know, the reason that we're involved is because they need organizations like ours that kind of ensure that this is not law enforcement. This isn't the government doing it. This is somebody from the community trying to help. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you know, this is kind of, you either got one or two options. You're going to either deal with law enforcement coming at you in a kind of aggressive way, or you can come talk to us and we could try to get it that you don't have to deal with law enforcement. You can get a program and get out this kind of stuff that's going on. Mm-hmm. So it's really, which one do you want, you know?
Emery, what's your involvement going to be with this particular operation?
Well, I'm the vice president of this organization, Let Your Voice Be Heard. Me and Miles, we pretty much go hand in hand. So, you know, it's the same roles pretty much, just reaching out to the community, getting resources for the kids, you know, just trying to make the community a better place, making kids stable, making sure that, you know, they're going in the right direction with their lifestyles and getting the proper resources that they need to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we spoke to you on Intersection a couple months ago, you spoke about, you know, what got you involved in this organization first, and I guess a little bit of your background. I mean, you're somebody who's sort of been through the criminal justice system. You've come out the other side. I'm wondering what kind of programs you wish you'd had access to when you were a kid growing up.
Yes, most definitely. I've had my experience. I would say a program like this, I mean, to fill in the gaps that I didn't have back then, you know, is just to give the kids direction and some type of sense of focus and hope, you know, because a lot of people nowadays, they're losing hope in what's to be and what's to be done. So we try to instill hope in them, and once they get hope, then they move forward, and we create, you know, different visions for them so they can see where they need to take their life to, mm-hmm. what direction to take their life in.
Now, when you work with folks in the community, what kind of form does that work take? Do you go to talk to school groups? Do you talk to youth groups? How does it all come together?
Well, it varies. Lately, we've been dealing with the community from many different aspects, from voters, from little kids, from churches, from many different aspects. So it varies.
Miles, what was it that motivated you to form your nonprofit? Because you've been incorporated for a year, but you were around before that, right?
Yeah, and honestly, I've grown up looking at people do things like this and didn't know how to do it myself. And even people like Zulu and people that I always credit, like Gino and other ones that, you know, he's actually passed and not here anymore. Mm-hmm. But
and he was
certain people,
just for our listeners, he was an activist in the Paramore.
Yeah,
era.
Gino was very active in the Paramore, and I grew up seeing him stay on the right path, and I grew up seeing people like Zulu change their life and be such a big figure and give back. So, you know, when I started, I wanted to be active, and I founded it on the premise of I wanted to bring together all the groups that are already doing something. Mm-hmm. So even though this is a nonprofit, the main focus is so many other people doing things. So one of our main things is to always credit all the other groups working, because we're real strong together. We just did a care fair last week at the fairgrounds. Mm-hmm. We had over 50 vendors and different nonprofits involved that we showed it's not just Let Your Voice Be Heard. It's so many other people here working. And, you know, it's either groups that I want to credit, like HBI and Saving Our Daughters and Orlando
Youth. What is HBI?
And HBI is actually an at-risk program for youth. They do mm-hmm. things where they get them out the workforce and get them some kind of advantages that been going through the juvenile detention kind of system. And then Saving Our Daughters takes the girls that have been at risk and they take them on different programs. So I've seen groups like this, and I wanted to be active and fill in the gaps, like Zulu said earlier. So we just kind of fill in the gaps and try to bridge everyone, because people so focused on the negative don't realize there's so much more positive out here than there is negative.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you talk about some of the organizations that were part of your community fair. Were they all local, or did you have some from outside the community coming in and saying, we want to be part
of
since
then, I mean, we started local, but we've reached out to groups in California, Kentucky, Illinois. It's all over the country right now. So Let Your Voice Be Heard started off with Orlando, Florida, but we've done stuff in Tallahassee. We've done stuff in San Francisco, Sacramento, Oakland, Richmond. We're doing stuff in Chicago next month. So we're literally trying to bridge the gaps with a lot of places. It was made to kind of learn from others and bring back what's needed to our city that we see others having that's been working. And that's what the ceasefire program's about. Our outreach program, we started it because we saw the kids getting in trouble at the school, getting into shootouts or fights. And we're like, you know what? We need to stand in the gap for them. Instead of complaining about it, let's get out there, show them something positive. And since then, it's been none of that.
Do you recognize something of yourself as a young man and some of the kids you talk to?
Most definitely. You know, growing up in certain impoverished areas, you know, it varies from broken homes, unstructured homes where you got single parents trying to raise kids. And sometimes you may have a mother that's at work all day and she's leaving the kids at home. And, you know, she's trying. But, you know, while she's at work, her son can be engaged in an activity that allows him to get caught up with the law. And, you know, once he gets in the system, he's in. Mm-hmm. So I can relate. And that's just the typical situation of being in an American society.
Miles, what's the relationship between folks in Pine Hills and the and law enforcement, whether it's sheriff's deputies or police officers? Because there's been a heightened presence, I guess, from law enforcement in the last year or so.
I mean, it depends because, you know, when we talk about Operation Rise, there was good and there was certain aspects that people didn't like. That's like with anything. So, you know, it's good to see more protection there. Mm-hmm. The only times that I know in general law enforcement when it gets kind of messed up is when the people who are just working hard are the ones getting pulled over and it's not actually happening. But Operation Rise, I'm not sure exactly how it took place. I know in general Pine Hills and the sheriffs, it's good to see them there. But, you know, we need more than just a police presence because a police car leaves, you could do whatever you want. That's not going to change the situation or the environment. So, you know, I don't think we should rely on law enforcement to be our main change or our main influence when it comes to changing our communities. Mm-hmm. It comes to us in the culture, you know, because if we don't hold ourselves accountable or even look at ourselves, it doesn't matter if they have 100 or 10 cops in the area. It's not going to change, you know. But I think in general, I think that we need to just also, people need to see that there's more people in the community that are doing stuff. It's more people than just Let Your Voice Be Heard. There's business owners, there's regular people who come volunteer. We have a real good support from people who come volunteer, get off work, come on their lunch break, and just volunteer. Mm-hmm. So it's real more that people need to see is the community is what's making the change, a real big part of it at least.
What kind of things do they volunteer with?
We do the outreach walks twice a month. So we'll go door to door. We'll talk to kids. We sign them up for mentoring groups. We have a lot of people come out and they do surveys with us, try to find out what needs we can meet in the community. We have people who come out and do the youth outreach. They could donate chips or drinks. We even put a GoFundMe up for that at the Youth Outreach LYVBH. It's a GoFundMe for us to kind of, because some people can't make it out all the time, so they want to come bring chips or donate so we can get it for them. We print out handouts. We get kids signed up. We do workshops during the days where we bring out different activities. And then we do stuff on the weekends also. So, you know, it's a lot of different activities we have going on monthly that people come out whenever they can or they support, they donate, they do whatever. And it's really a village mentality that's making this change. It's not just us. We may be the mouthpiece of it, but really we are empowered by so many people who are behind us helping us do what we do.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're with Emery James and Miles Mulrain from Let Your Voice Be Heard in Pine Hills, talking about some of the efforts to build up the community in Pine Hills. I want to ask, too, about those peace walks. Now, back in April, there were some headlines around a peace walk. You were holding this peace walk with your organization, and this was just a couple of hours after a couple of people were killed at a nightclub. Do you feel like there's some pressure on you, you know, with headlines like that? Does that?
I mean, it's weird because, you know, I actually know the owner of the nightclub, and I know the incident happened away from the nightclub, and she even was, like, feeling some kind of, it was real hard to see, you know. But honestly, you know, with the peace walks and what we do, it kind of makes sense. So that day was April 29th. There was a double homicide before, and there was a homicide while we was actually walking. So literally some of our people saw this, the actual situation happen. And a lot of times people are like, well, you know, should you get out of there? I'm like, no, we need to be here more. Because while we're there more, people are seeing it more, they notice a more of a presence, they won't do the same things because they know it's more people who care. Mm-hmm. We got a walk coming up July 29th this month. It's going to be a major walk. It's the second annual Stop the Violence All-White Tea Walk through Pine Hills. So we meet at the Art Christian Center at 6 o'clock. It's right there on Pine Hills and Silver Star. We walk through with hundreds of people in all white. When people see that, they'll come off the street and come walk with us because they're like, wow, how can I stay more active? So sometimes our presence is needed because you might have three people who suffered and other people who are involved, but you got hundreds who want change and are willing to help the change. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to alienate the people who want to help just off of a couple people who are getting in trouble.
Is it frustrating, though?
You know what? It's not frustrating. It's more like it makes sense. You know, what would be frustrating to me is if we weren't doing anything or making any change. Mm-hmm. Since last year, the crime rates dropped 37% in Pine Hills alone. So we know it's making some change with all the other groups involved. We just know that we got to keep pushing. So it's kind of like reinsurance. Like, you don't want to go somewhere that everyone has what they need and you're not doing nothing that's effective. I want to go somewhere that people need us and we actually are making a change, even if it's one person or 100 people. You know, the change is what's necessary.
Do you know what the breakdown is of that crime rate drop? I mean, what about violent crime?
Yeah, violent crime. So it went from 30 homicides to 19. And just from this halfway mark in a year, just looking at 2016 and looking at this year, it went from 30 to 19. And they haven't got the official number of the youth crime rate, but even Captain Torres from Orange County Sheriff's has said they expect that number to drop down significantly from last year of the youth crime, you know, the youth arrest. Mm-hmm. So we see the change. You know, we even see it when we see less fights. We see a change in how the kids come at us or how they embrace what we do. Mm-hmm. And at first, they weren't really accepting what we were doing. You know, it was like selling used cars to somebody. We had to kind of, hey, come get this help. Now we set up and post up. They'll run to us like, hey, when's this next thing coming up? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the biggest thing that keeps us going.
Emery, do you feel like you were kind of like a used car dealer from the get-go?
I mean, yeah, pretty much. But, you know, like you said, now everybody's getting receptive, man. They see the soul being put back into the community. Mm-hmm. And that's the most beautiful thing, man, when people embrace, you know, the work that you're doing, and they see the effects of it. And, you know, the key thing is just show people love, man, and just keep it moving. Mm-hmm. Love, love at the end of the day can heal the world.
Are there some kids, though, you talk to and you think, here is somebody I'm going to have a hard time reaching?
Yeah, there are some cases where, you know, they're different from others, but we try to use the best remedy and strategy and method that we can to reach the individuals that's complicated. So mm-hmm. we just pray and we try our best, man, to the best of our ability.
What do people in Pine Hills need? What do the residents need most as far as resources and things?
When it comes to resources, I think the main focus is getting more, you know, getting the economy back thriving, more entrepreneurs, more local businesses getting favored when it comes to contracts and getting some of the stuff that's going on in developing Orlando. I think that they need to be involved more with it instead of just being on the outside of it. One of the things that now just like to use all the time is that if we got 100 bins of food in one area and we move 200 people there, somebody's going to be missing out. So we got more people moving to Pine Hills regularly because of all the changes in Orlando, all the places being torn down, and we're not putting more resources to replenish Pine Hills. So we got to replenish Pine Hills before we say, hey, why is there so much crime here? But if you go anywhere, I don't care what society it is, if you only got 50 barrels of food and it's 100 people, 50 people are going to be without and more because somebody's going to be greedy. And so we need to put more stuff back in the area before we start, you know, demonizing what's going on.
It seems to me that this is a long-term project, right?
Definitely.
How committed are you? Like, how long are you going to be doing this
Yeah, we're going to be doing this. Like, you know, when we stop, me and Zulu stop, you know, we're probably going to be raising our kids to pick it up, you know, and we're raising the kids that we meet now. I think our biggest advantage is that it's not just about me and Zulu. We're able to empower others, and even if we move on to a different place or we have whatever happens, someone could pick up, and two of us go down, it might be six of us rise up. Mm-hmm. And that's what we try to keep going.
Well, Miles Mulrain Jr. is the CEO of Let Your Voice Be Heard in Pine Hills. Thank you so much, Miles.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Emery Zulu Dynasty James. Thank you so much as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Alana Campbell. If you missed an episode, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can also find us on the NPR One app or listen on our website, WMFE.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.